Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 106 of Season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Matthew Simpson, freelance film critic. Welcome back to the show this season, Matthew.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure, as always. I'm very excited to talk about this.
Yes.
Spoiler alert, my favorite Die Hard.
Ooh. Okay, so why don't we start from there? Why don't you tell everyone, what your history is with this movie?
So I was born in 81, so I was a teenager in the 90s. Die Hard 3 came out in 1995. And my teenage years was definitely the years where I sort of came into my own as like a guy who was going to be a movie nerd. And I hadn't yet.
I hadn't
started working in the movie theater yet. I worked in the local movie theater of my tiny hometown when I was about a year older than this, or 2 years older than this, I guess, probably 97. But in about 94 was the year that. So I live in Canada, for those of you who don't know. And I lived in a very small place, and we were unable to get anything other than like the four channels that broadcast over the air until the early mid 90s, when my dad signed up for a gray market 10-foot satellite dish. So for the kids out there, that's like DirecTV, but the dish is literally 3 meters across, 10 feet across. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And like in Canada, it's illegal to receive broadcast signals from another country. But if you have an address in the States, like, say, Point Roberts, which is literally like a stone's throw from where I lived, they will sell it to you and sort of turn a blind eye. So that's what we did. Anyway, the moral, the short version of this is that we eventually, through this, had HBO. And 1995, after the film had done, more than a bit of business in cinemas, it eventually came on HBO, and I watched it roughly a million times through the 90s. And I had seen Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 2. But this is the one that, like, this was the one that was sort of the formative Die Hard for me. It's the one I've seen the most times. It's the one that I think is the funniest. It's the one where I think I do like Al. I do like Reginald Vell Johnson from the first one. But I really, really, this is also basically my formative Samuel L. Jackson movie too.
Okay. You're giving away things you're going to be talking about later this week, but okay. But that is perfectly okay. I mean, you know what? Why not? What do you think about the ending of this movie? Do you think that this movie has a good ending, or do you feel that it's just tacked on? I know we're talking a few weeks ahead of things, but since you mentioned that you like this one better than the other movies, I love this movie, I really do, but I don't think it's the best of the Die Hard trilogy, largely due to the fact that the ending isn't as satisfying as the ending of the other two, because this one just feels completely tacked on. I mean, obviously there's the whole history, the script has the ending that didn't work, then they have the one with the missile that didn't work that they actually filmed, and then they have this one, which just feels tacked on to me.
Yeah, I've never minded this ending. I think it's pretty well set up. I think that I personally don't really feel like it's tacked on, and I think that is actually illuminated for me because of something we're going to talk about in the minutes we're going to talk about this week. I think the ending is set up in those minutes pretty well. And I have seen the other ending that they filmed, and it is way too dark and way too cynical. And I think this one works a lot better, personally. So I think the ending is fine. I think you're right. I think the ending of Die Hard 1 is... I will concede that whilst this is my favorite Die Hard 1 is probably the best of the trilogy, just from like... as much of an objective place as any art appraisal can be. I think it's probably the best one. And, the first one is often, of any franchise, is often sort of the one that needs to spark something. And I think it does. But I think the Inuvis one is fine. I think it's totally serviceable, and I like it.
Okay. Again, my point is that of the three endings, the one they have here is the best, but I still think it's just not as good as one would like. That's what I'm saying. That's my point.
Yeah, and I get where you're coming from. I think it's fine. I like it totally fine. I think I like it at least as much as I like the first one. And maybe a little better than the second one. The second one has that nice, it's Christmas moment with, wow, his name's gone out of my head. The guy who plays the airport cop who was on NYPD Blue.
Dennis Franz.
Yeah, that's the one. I think that, I guess I'm a little disappointed. It's never bothered me because I watched this one so many times, but like in thinking about it in this moment, I guess you could say I'm a little disappointed that we don't actually get to see Holly in this one. And maybe that would have been nice. But I like the way it ends where it like with him, you know, taking steps towards reconciliation, even if it's probably way too late. Like it's, because he's a
yeah exactly. I mean they were setting things up for 4 and 5.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Which of course
they knew where they were going there.
Yeah, and four and five of course famously never happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely. All right. So minute 106 begins with Simon giving a direction, and ends with Zeus possibly starting to get scared. We'll have to discuss that when we get there. But we ended things on Friday with basically Simon having captured John on the bridge, and he starts telling his men what to do, and he says take him, and then he says below. Below is the only word we get to hear from him right at the beginning here. You know, as one of the henchmen starts lifting John up, who looks like he's in a lot of pain. We'll find out later this week why he's in so much pain, even though we've seen the blood over the last few weeks. But they don't really go into that too much as to what the real issue is here, you know, that type of thing. Well, then Simon goes, careful now. He turns and says, do you have the communique? Now, did you notice that there is, while Simon is looking around, you know, we get a quick shot of this like little red box on the wall. You can see that second 12.
So I'm looking, there's a little red box just on the left of the frame. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So can you read what it says there?
I can't actually. What does it say?
It says Brenna alarm. And I was like, wow. I found something really interesting, and I'm going to look it up. And then I went in and looked up what Brenna alarm is, and it's actually Norwegian for fire alarm. That's it.
Oh. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Most of these boats like this, as I learned from my father, the sailor, most of these boats are from other places. So that makes sense.
Yeah. So what do you know about fire alarm systems?
I mean, I know they all alarm you that there's a fire.
They are alarming. Very good.
Yeah. I know that, shipboard ones are very loud because fires on ships are very, very bad. And they can also, depending on the system, some of them do have, like, fire suppression systems that can be triggered. But that is about the extent of my knowledge.
All right. So, I mean, basically the whole idea of a fire alarm is a system to detect and alert people and also emergency services if there is fire, smoke, carbon monoxide, other fire-related emergencies and stuff like that. Most buildings nowadays require some sort of fire alarm, commercial buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Houses have smoke detectors also, heat detectors. Something like this, which is known as a pull station. And the whole idea is to tell people that get out. That's more or less what it is. Some of them are able to disable elevators, because they always say you shouldn't be in an elevator when there's a fire going on, stuff like that. You know, different countries have different standards of what's needed and stuff like that. We're not going to go into all of those things. Obviously, in the, you know, there is the idea also of false alarms, which quite often can happen because the system itself is faulty, not necessarily because someone is pulling the alarm. You know, I mean, this is a callback to the first Die Hard, where John actually, you know, pulls a fire alarm and tries to get the attention of, you know, some sort of service, emergency services to come and save him in the building, or save everyone in the building, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. And famously, it's called off as a false alarm.
That is correct. That is correct. And then the problem, obviously, with many false alarms is the whole idea of, you know, crying wolf.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where if you have too many false alarms, people will actually then just no longer believe that there actually is a real fire.
Yep. I'm so which, far.
You know, which, again, is a callback to the first Die Hard, where they go, oh, that's probably just another goose chase by the computer system that's been buggy since they installed it.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
So now I like the fact that Simon is using a handkerchief, you know, as he's holding on to the to the CB radio, you know, to try and keep his fingerprints off of it.
Okay.
Even though, you know, the rest of the time that we've seen him in the ship, he wasn't concerned about that at all.
So I was actually,
you know, not at all.
I was wondering about that too. Do you think he's using the handkerchief because he doesn't want to get his fingerprints on the ship he's about to blow up? Or do you think he's using it because if you look closely, that receiver is covered in blood?
Well, we'll get there in a few seconds because there is something to that. So at this point, Simon then says into the CB, Bridgeport radio, come in, please. Bridgeport, Coast Guard, are you there, dear? Yes, we're here. Do you have the ability to record a message? Now, you'd think even in 1995, that's a pretty strange question to ask, because the obvious answer is probably yes. You'd think that 911 services or the Coast Guard, that they do have a way of recording. So I think that's more for us, you know, so that we can know, you know, that they say, okay, look, hey, there's a reason that of what Simon's about to do here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes, okay, and she says yes. And he goes, then please begin now. Like, okay, 3, 2, 1, start recording.
Yeah, it's quite abrupt. Like, does he know? He has no way to know if there's just like a radio system, like a recording system hooked up, or if she has to like grab something if he just says go.
Right. My assumption is he knows it's just to press a button.
Yeah.
You know. And then he like puts a tape recorder, you know, on the side, and finds a way to have the CB stay pressed in, you know, the whole thing. But at this point, he no longer needs the handkerchief, and you don't see any blood on his hands from this whole thing. So the question there is, it goes back to what we just said a few minutes ago. You know, why was he using the handkerchief? I mean, again, I can completely understand if he doesn't want his fingerprints being there, even though everyone knows that Simon Gruber is the guy who has caused all this havoc in New York. You know, and his expectation is that everyone's going to know that Simon Gruber is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter if his fingerprints are there.
No, I think it's like if you look closely, there's blood all over the receiver. I'm pretty convinced he's using the handkerchief just so he doesn't get his hands any dirtier than they already are.
Okay, but do you see blood on the handkerchief? I don't see any blood on the handkerchief.
Maybe it's dry. It's a good question.
Right. Okay. On the cover thing, there is blood. Yes.
Oh,
but you only see
also,
that at the end.
You know what it might also just be? It might be dumb, but in a previous scene, like prior to the minutes we're talking about when he's on the bridge with Zeus, he's eating. Maybe he just has a handkerchief because he was eating.
Because he was eating an egg.
Yeah, you know.
Do you eat eggs with a handkerchief?
I usually have a napkin around if I'm eating anything, really. you know, just to wipe my hands off when I'm done. Maybe that's it.
Okay. I mean, we talked about this 2 weeks ago. He also has a salt and pepper shaker there, which I thought was hilarious. You know, talk about detail.
I mean, that's a nice little character detail, actually, if he's, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Now, we just talked about the fact that Simon asked her if she has the ability to record. Now, what would he have done if she said no?
I imagine he would have said, okay, listen carefully, and I'm going to, here comes a message, would be my guess. But yeah, it would have been kind of an interesting moment for sure.
Or he would say, can you transfer me to somebody who can record this?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's just a funny little way to look at it. And then, you know, he presses the play button, and we start hearing, Simon's diatribe, which is also very reminiscent of Hans's diatribe from the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is a communique from the CRF, which I don't know what the CRF stands for. For too long, the West has conspired to steal the world, wealth of the world, consigning the balance of humanity to economic starvation. Today, we will level the playing field. In a few minutes, the contents of the Federal Reserve Bank, the gold your economies are built on, will be redistributed by explosives across the bottom of the Long Island Sound. If you're not in gridlock, I invite you to come and watch. So when you know the Grubbers, you know this is complete BS, everything that he's saying here. You know, they like to espout political problems and aspirations and stuff like that when it's all over red herring. So it's fun that they add that in here, and that they're trying to make it seem more political than it really is.
Yeah, I mean, it's I actually really like how this film ties how Simon operates back to the same sort of way that Hans operated. That they share a playbook and share motivations, which we'll get into, I think. But actually, we get into it a little more next week with somebody else, right?
Yeah.
We're going to start talking about that.
No, okay. But no, we will talk a little bit about it this week also. We feel the things here. It's just very strange the way that they did do this. You know, the way that it's mentioned here. Again, it's just to make us believe that something else is happening here.
Yeah, and it's also because, you know, at every step of the way in his plan, he's been offering, you know, misdirects and misinformation to confuse the police. And I think it's just another step, another version of that for this step of the plan, you know, to right. obfuscate what he's really doing, because he's obviously not going to blow up all the money. So... and putting a whole bunch, trying to get as many people down there to look at that, to look at the explosion, it's actually kind of a genius to get, so all these people can be like, oh yeah, I saw the boat blow up, and be like, not necessarily firsthand witnesses to the actual gold, be firsthand witnesses to the event, and just sow more and more misinformation. It's a kind of a genius plan, actually.
Yeah, I mean, even though this is completely not in the script, this whole idea of the way they're doing this is just,
mm-hmm.
you know, it really, it fits within the diehard scheme of things, mm-hmm. you know, that nothing is what it really seems.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, as much as I detest the fifth movie and find the fourth movie to be okay, this is a theme that goes through all five movies.
Yeah, and I'll agree with you there. I actually think the fourth movie, as an aside, I think the fourth movie is actually pretty good. It just doesn't feel like a Die Hard movie, if that makes
Correct.
Sense.
Right. It feels like they tried to make it too much of an action movie than a Die Hard type of movie.
Well, it just also it also makes... My biggest problem with it is that it makes John McClane into a superhero a little bit, as opposed right. to the like vulnerable... both physically and emotional guy that he is in the first three.
Right. Okay, I completely agree. I actually just rewatched 4 and 5 last week, and it helped strengthen the fact that that I like 4, and helped strengthen the fact that I actually hate 5. But oh well. Okay.
That's because 5 is really bad. It's not a
Oh,
good
it's
movie.
terrible. It's terrible. 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 Really is. So they mentioned the he mentions the Long Island Sound. You have any idea what that is?
Long Island Sound is what is another word for sound? It's a sound just off Long Island in New York State. It's the space between the mainland and Long Island, isn't it?
Yes, it's the area
Basically a
where the like New York the Long Island juts out, so it's the space
yeah.
in between. It's north of that and south of Connecticut. That whole area.
Big natural weather protected harbor. Apparently I haven't been there, but apparently a beautiful spot in the world too.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's what it's known is it's known as a juridical bay, which means that it's been in dispute among New York, Rhode Island, and the United States. Because the states want to have jurisdiction over it, and so does the government. So
I mean,
the
that
question
makes sense.
is like, where is the legal coastline of the U.S.? Does it go inland, and or is it something that, or is this part of the U.S.? That type of thing.
I,
Which
no, I would.
is a great idea, to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume that the border of the country must be outside of that, but. Yeah, who owns it, I guess, is the
Right.
yeah, interesting. I'm just looking that up right now.
And there are like ferries that travel between Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Port Jefferson, and New London, and Orient Point, going back and forth between Long Island and Connecticut, which is very cool also.
Marine laws are
Which
so
take
interesting and weird. I like it.
Exactly. The last thing that he mentions here is gridlock. Are you familiar with what gridlock is?
Well, I think anyone with a car in a city is familiar with what gridlock is, especially if you've been in a place like New York or LA or to, I guess the biggest city I've been in gridlock in would be Toronto, which famously has a highway called Don Valley Parkway, which is lovingly referred to as the Don Valley parking lot. So yeah, I agree. I know what gridlock is. It's terrible.
Right. So, I mean, basically, the idea of gridlock is that someone is stuck making a left turn into onto another street because there was a green light and now it's a red light, and therefore you're blocking other traffic from continuing and stuff like that. It's actually an example of game theory, something that's called Prisoner's Dilemma.
Yeah, where you need to either work in your own interest or work in the group's interest. And which of
Correct.
those things should you do? That's always
That's
an
right.
interesting problem in it's actually an interesting one when it comes up in film as a plot point too.
Right.
Like in, say, the
That's cool.
Saw movies or something like that.
Correct. Now in New York City, there's a fine if you're part of gridlock. And it's actually known as block the box. And it's
Sorry,
a moving violation.
block the bucks.
Block the box.
Okay,
BOX.
interesting. I
Yeah,
did
and
not know that.
there is a $90 penalty. And you can get 2 points on your license also.
How many points can you have on your license in New York State? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know either. I think it's 10. But I could be wrong. But basically, the idea was that Bloomberg wanted to change things when he was mayor, because he realized that the time that it takes to actually give someone a ticket contributes also to the traffic congestion.
Yeah, that's true. Any slowdown causes more slowdown.
Right. Exactly. But I can always remember this story that my stepfather once, this must have been like 30 years ago when we were in New York, he actually got ticketed for it. And we weren't living in New York. So when he got the ticket by mail that he had to pay it or whatever it is, so he wrote on the envelope, deceased, return to sender. And they never bothered him again.
I mean, that's a pretty compelling argument. Were you living in the United States or outside the United States?
Yeah, we were living in Michigan. We were living in Michigan at the time.
I mean, hey, if they can't find you, they can't collect, right?
Yeah, my stepfather was known for doing all these things. He would write he would get tickets every so often for things, you know, when we were visiting New York. And I recall that one time he also wrote on an envelope, move to New York. Yeah, let them go try and find him in New York, you know, that type of thing. So, yeah, what can I say?
That's pretty great, actually.
Yeah, yeah. He was a funny person to be around. He passed away 11 years ago, so I don't, you know. But it would have been interesting to have these type of conversations with him, you know, to see his thoughts on things. Then in Virginia Beach, Virginia, they also have a law against gridlock, and you can actually get a $200 fine if you block the box there. And in Austin, Texas, and in San Antonio, they recently started also programs of trying to. It's funny that every place is known as "Don't Block the Box."
I imagine it must be some person or some regulatory body like copying each other over time.
Yeah, it sounds that way. Now, do you know where the term gridlock comes from?
No, I don't.
The word gridlock was coined in the early 1970s, and then it started appearing in newspapers in the early 80s. There was a New York City transit strike. The people, you know, who was the chief traffic engineer for the New York City Department of Transportation, he used that in a memo talking about the biggest problem that they have. Is he used the word gridlock, and the idea is basically it's locking up the grid. The grid being, especially in New York, you know, most of the streets are parallel to one another, and they form nice little boxes that looks like a grid.
Yep,
the way it is. So basically you're locking up the grid.
We got tracks.
Yep. During us hearing the recording from Simon, we see that Katya is standing above this new bomb where John and Zeus are tied up on the bomb. Mm-hmm. And you know they're being slowly lowered into the hull of this ship. And you know I've until I started doing this minute by minute, I didn't even think about the fact that, do you know that Katya doesn't say a single word in the entire movie? She's like mute.
Yeah, she doesn't have any lines. She just has searing glares and dangerous sex appeal.
That's right. That's right. And at the same time, she also like points at things and stuff like that, you know.
And she does shoot people and kill people.
Yes.
Brutally.
We might see that this week. I don't know. Maybe. Possibly. But here, she's the person that they put on top of this, on top of this rig that's being lowered down into the hull. Which, again, this is completely being done for our benefit. You know, and I love that we can see all the blood on top of it, which is probably like John's blood from when they had to get him up on top of it. Yeah, you know, on top of one of these white canisters.
He's still bleeding pretty profusely at this point from the
wound
in his arm.
Correct. But he's bleeding profusely from his wound in his arm, but he's still trying to get out of those handcuffs. You know, mm-hmm. you see that he's doing his best with it. But again, I like the fact that we sort of have this as a voiceover. You know, everything that's going on as John is being lowered into there. John and Zeus are being lowered into there. Mm-hmm. And then she gives one of those looks that you mentioned as she, you know, slowly rappels down off the side. And then we get the minute ends as Zeus is looking up, watching the I guess the doors of the hole being closed on them. And he looks like he might be getting a little scared. You know, I think Zeus has finally realized that you know, maybe he made some mistakes today.
Yeah, it's definitely the first moment where he's feeling like they're maybe truly stuck, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. And that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute?
No, that pretty much covers it, actually. Okay. Solid minute of the movie, though. Like, it's,
Every minute in this movie is a solid minute. True. Come on.
But this is sort of the beginning of the turn into the third act, which I think is kind of cool.
Right. Correct. So we don't have any script to talk about because none of this appears in the script because this is something that was completely changed. And so every Monday we have a segment called McTiernan Monday where my guests will give their top five John McTiernan films. So Matthew, why don't you tell us what you think, how you would rank the 11 McTiernan films?
Well, do you want me to go from bottom to top or top to bottom?
Go from bottom to top.
Okay, so...
Start with number five. We don't need all 11.
Right, so my number five is a film I actually just rewatched the other day, actually. I was thinking about it in thinking about coming on the show. And it's the very slick, very sexy heist film, The Thomas Crown Affair, starring Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo, which is maybe... I don't know, is that... you? Obviously talking to a lot of people so far. This is week 22 of the show, right? So like how many other people chosen that one as in the top five, like at all?
You have you're the ninth person to choose it.
Oh, interesting. I did not think, for some reason I didn't think it was that popular, but I really like it. It's maybe a little slight, but it's very, very slick, very tight little heist film that I really enjoy.
But only one person had it in their number one slot.
Oh, interesting.
You know?
Interesting, yeah. Mostly because
no, you're the fifth person to have it in their number five slot.
Interesting that only one person has it in their number five, but that's mostly because I kind of wouldn't.
No, in their number one.
Sorry, the number one.
No, no, no,
in
no,
number
no,
one.
No.
Sorry.
In their number one.
But mostly because I kind of wouldn't expect anyone to have it in their number one spot. That seems.
Neither would I.
Like, in the dude only made 11 films, but several of them are like all timers. And I would say that Thomas Crown is a great movie, but not an all timer like some of the other ones are, you know?
Correct.
So for number four, we're going to go with the most 80s movies that 80 ever 80s, and that is the Arnold Schwarzenegger starring Predator, which is a perfect action film. I don't know what I can say about Predator that hasn't already been said before. It's a wonderful inversion of expectations with these big burly heroes being hunted and systematically killed. Great performance from Arnold Schwarzenegger and everyone else in the cast, and kicked off a franchise that I dearly love to this day.
Cool.
Moving along, and this might be where things get slightly controversial, I don't know. But my number three is Die Hard, the first Die Hard, which again is a perfect movie. But since this list is entirely subjective, and my list, it's number three, with Die Hard with a Vengeance coming in by a nose in number two.
Okay.
So I think, again, like, I will concede that perhaps Die Hard is the superior film, but Die Hard 3, Die Hard with a Vengeance, is my Die Hard. And
okay, and that's how you're choosing this. So that's okay.
Yeah. And then in my number one spot is a movie that I consider to be perfect. The Hunt for Red October, which I'm assuming a lot of people have that in their top five. I'm curious how many people have it as a number one, but I think The Hunt for Red October is basically a perfect thriller. Great performances, great tension building, great military drama, wonderful Alec Baldwin performance, top tier Sean Connery performance. And also just like from a filmmaking perspective in terms of like shot composition and choices and the way it deals with the language disparity between the Russians and the Americans. I have seen, so The Hunt for Red October is another one of those ones that I watched on that, you know, HBO on that 10-foot satellite dish. And I also have seen it roughly a million times. And it is one of my all-time favorite movies and easily my favorite of McTiernan's films.
Well, okay. So just to answer your question, there are only three people who didn't have it on their top five, and you are the third person to have it as the number one.
That's respectable. I can dig it.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. So Matthew would like to tell people where they can find you.
Yeah. So I am the host of the Awesome Friday podcast, which each week we review two new films. We're recording a little bit ahead, so I don't know what our next episode will be when you're listening to this, but as of today, the most recent episode we recorded was A Quiet Place Day One and Deadpool and Wolverine, so it'll give you an idea of the delay from recording for the show to release for the show. I'm also a freelance film critic. I write for a number of outlets, including but not limited to Exclaim.ca and ThatShelf.com and Movies We Texted About, and For Real, and a number of others. And the easiest way to catch up with all of that, because it's sort of spread all over the place, is to check out my personal portfolio site, which is called Stretched.ca. You can also find me on all the socials. I'm at MatthewAF on basically all of them.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to shoot me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
Marching home again, hurrah, hurrah! We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.